that brings you tidbits from all aspects of the soccer world. Sometimes serious, sometimes zany, always opinionated. Now, here are your hosts, Chad Smith and Corey Chatelaine.
This is the 2DAF Yanks podcast. Greetings to you wherever you may be. I am your host, Chad Smith. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Corey Chatelaine.
I just have one question. Did the MLS bots try to claim Argentina's goal by proxy because of Higuain's brother in the MLS?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know.
Okay, yeah. We're going to have to get on that. I think they should.
Okay, well, I'll do a Twitter search after the show.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so Corey's with us today as always, and today we'd also like to introduce somebody, a new friend of the show, John Townsend, who is a soccer writer, and he runs farpostfooty.com. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and the crowd goes wild.
Yeah.
So we are here after the loss to Belgium to focus on the future of U.S. soccer and how that future needs to be shaped because of the development of a better and a more technically adept and tactically sound player pool is obviously needed after seeing the results against Belgium and in Germany. And so American hard work and determinism is a great thing for us to have, and it could get you very far. But for us to crack into the soccer elite where Corey and I would like us to be, we really need to develop the technical side and the tactical side of the game here in America. So
the nous, that is going to be, as they would say in England.
What was that? Sorry, I missed what that. I was talking over you.
We got to have the nous, as they would say.
The nous, yes. So that is the theme of today's show, folks. It's a one-topic show, and we have John Townsend with us because he is currently developing a book on this subject, and he does a lot of writings on this of late. So he is our expert next to Corey and I's daftness.
Yeah. Bringing some legitimacy to the show. We're going to have to stop this.
All right. So let's just start with this first general question, and we'll throw it to John. In your opinion, what should the American youth development system look like to order to develop these technical and tactical abilities?
It's a great question, Chad. One of the things that I've been a very, very big proponent of is eliminating the importance of winning at young ages and increasing the importance of producing technical players. So what that means in layman's terms is don't keep score, don't keep standings, and let's try to, if we must, give everyone a trophy at the end, but let's focus on producing players that are comfortable on the ball, that are creative, and are not looking over their shoulder and cowering when they miss a shot or mistrap a ball. I think if we look at other countries and how they do it, we can safely say that they're doing something that we are not, which is not focusing on the scoreline, but focusing on the product on the field. So my contention is from the youngest ages, from maybe 6, 7, 8, all the way up to 13, 14, I don't think players should be on full-size pitches running around like wild animals. I don't think they should be held to keeping standings in the leagues. They can keep scoring games, for sure. That does play a role. Competitiveness is a good thing. But if we focus on the scoreline and wins-losses, we're losing sight of development, and we're losing sight of developing players that can go on to win games when it actually matters at the older age levels and the professional level. So what I really believe the development system should look like would almost follow a Dutch model where they produce technicians on the ball very early on. Everything the child does with the ball is geared toward producing players that are comfortable, that are intelligent, that are problem solvers, thinkers, and can economize in new space economy. They can play on a small size field and be comfortable with having a guy next to them or a girl next to them. And they're not scared when they get the ball. I think one of the things that I've noticed, and I'm a product of the American system, is our coaches and parents would rather see us run hard, kick and, you know, go through somebody than actually play with our teammates, create something. They'd rather us score a goal off our kneecap or, you know, off our face than, you know, have a pattern of play that leads to a movement that creates a goal. It's maximizing the dependence on the athlete, not the soccer player, and there's a key differentiator there. We have guys that would, you know, going back to when I was younger, the fat kids in goal, the super athlete on the team is up top running through people, and that's somehow okay. Well, if you look at the last 20 years of American soccer, we aren't able to compete when it matters because we aren't producing players that are able to be composed and share the ball with their teammates, as we saw against Belgium.
Yeah, because the only thing I would add to that is that I don't necessarily know if like keeping score itself and keeping standings, I don't think those things are inherently bad per se. But I do think where sometimes we kind of lose the plot in this country, at least when it comes to youth sports, is that second place isn't the end of the world. Third place isn't the end of the world. So, you know, it's kind of like what I jokingly call the Ricky Bobby syndrome that a lot of people have in this country, where somehow second place is, you know, everything other than winning is bad, and that you need to revamp everything because you didn't win, or that somehow because you won, the method you're doing it is technically correct, or, you know, winning automatically equates to a correct point of view, when that's not necessarily the case at the youth level, because, like you said, maybe you did everything to win, but you didn't actually develop any players that are going to play beyond, you know, high school or college or whatever.
Right. Well, you know, one of the biggest factors that plays into what you're saying, which is an awesome point, is, you know, if you're not first, you're last. I think it's what Ricky Bobby said. But I as a player and as a coach and as a fan of the game, I think there's way more to gain and learn from losses than a win, especially an ugly win. And I think a lot of our young players equate losing with almost being a loser. And that's very right. American in a lot of ways. That's why we have, you know, weird playoff systems and sudden death and all these awesome misnomers that really create this pressurized environment. I contend, and I do agree with you, and one of the things I will add is this is a problem across the spectrum of American sports. You know, it's not just a soccer problem. This is a problem with many sports. And now, if we're talking about development, we'll stick to soccer for sure. But, you know, standings and score, they're on some level very important. They should not be the focus, which is my argument right, is. Right. And I think that's where we need to definitely see some change at the younger levels.
Now, it's interesting to me that you you bring up the size and the athleticism thing, to where, you know, the big fast kid is always played at striker, and then the slower kid is, you know, he's put in goal. And that's not a problem that we're having just here in America. If you follow English football as well, their fan base is having the same, they say the same things about the way they're developing. So
yeah,
this isn't a problem that it's just we
and they've been at
in this
for
country are having.
Years, so.
Yeah, so they've kind of gone down the wrong path. And so not necessarily that we haven't gone down the wrong path here, because, you know, the modern, I mean, really, we've only been playing soccer in modern times at the international level here for the last, you know, 20, 25 years. So there's time to turn this all around and do what we need to do. But if England can make the mistakes, it's easy for someone like us to do it as well. And we don't want to go down that road.
Well, but part of that, and hopefully we'll get into that in a few minutes, is that it's because, you know, we're basically a byproduct of English culture for the most part. Culturally, we are kind of taught or forced to believe that, you know, what I jokingly call the strapping young lad model, that the tallest, most athletic kid is better than the kid who happens to be shorter, and that that, like you said, that the taller athletic guy is going to play up front, because in the way we perceive an athlete, that is automatically more athletic because he's taller and bigger. When he might actually not be the best athlete per se. He just viewed that way because of the way we view people culturally.
Point in case would be Bambi on Ice himself, Mr. Peter Crouch.
Exactly. Exactly. Or, you know, look at how many times, you know, English clubs are like, oh, well, he's got to play out on the wing because he's short. Well, you know, why not? Why not just adapt the game to more on-the-ground game because he's short, you know? But so, yeah, so anyway, that's where I would just add to where I think that's where they make the same mistakes, or we make the same mistakes they do, because it's a cultural thing, or, you know, it's an inherent cultural thing, not necessarily a sports thing at that point.
I think your point is awesome, because growing up, I'm 29 years old, and growing up, I think anybody in America who had a coach with an accent was all of a sudden he was an entitled authority. So for a long time, I think a lot of, and this is not a fault of anyone who's from England or the UK coming over to try to play or coach here. I think we bought into the Route 1 football. We bought into, well, they play it more than we play it, so therefore we need to do what they do. I think England is a victim of its own system, and I think we're a victim of trying to find the right system, but in doing so, developing none, kind of becoming a jack-of-all-trades, master of none in our own development. And one of the things that you brought up was just using physical attributes as a determining factor for positions. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes a young coach or a young player can assume is big equals great in soccer. You know, we talk about this athleticism, and, you know, what a LeBron James or what a Dwayne Wade do well at soccer. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but having size 22 feet probably isn't going to be conducive to having a good first touch, or being able to run around the. I mean, I think Peter Crouch is what, 6'7". I don't think putting a 7'2", you know, kind of freak of nature out there in terms of athletic ability, a specimen, is really going to get us where we need to be. You know, and I think we've talked about this before, whether it's been on Twitter or not. If had Messi grown up in the U.S., he might have been cut for being too small or being, you know, too left-footed, or, you know, just so we try to, you know, shoehorn people into these positions based on what we think the idea of what we want to play is like, but in reality, it's not where we need to be. And I think you guys make a great point when you say in the past 25 years, you know, as we get in the modern football, what are we trying to do here? What's our goal? So, good points.
Yeah, because again, it's not to say that that tall athletic guy can't do the job. It's just, like you said, unfortunately, most people just automatically assume that, oh, well, he's tall, he's got to play striker, he's got to play center back, when maybe he does have a weird, really good technique on the ball, and he puts in crosses. So who cares if he's 6'3"? Put him out on the wing because he plays at the wing, you know?
Right.
Okay. Now, John, you bring up this idea of to where we're borrowing concepts from other nations, and so we're kind of not really focusing on a couple things. You know, you said the jack of all trades, the master of none. So. I guess what would you, just looking right now, is what would you say is the positive things that we have in our setup, and what are the ones that are most needed to be fixed, and then to what direction might we look to fix them?
The positives are we have a ton, actually. You know, I might appear as a pessimist, but we have everything we need in this country already. We have the infrastructure, we have the parks, we have the availability to play. We have enough teams. We have enough coaches. It's just better educating these entities to be successful. So when I look at systems that we could implement, I would like to assume, and I don't like to assume very often, but that we can look at this and stop being so a la carte by saying, well, let's develop our midfielders like Argentina. Let's develop our strikers like, you know, Brazil. That's not going to work because it's cultural. You know, if we look at what I believe is the route forward, it's simplifying the game. We really have the kids who are willing to play, willing to put the time in. We just need to show them how. And I think our coaching education system, one of my biggest criticisms of it is, and I've, you know, done some of the SSF coaching courses, is we teach our coaches one thing, and then at the national level, we do something completely different when we bring in, you know, whatever coach is there, whatever philosophy they believe. So from the top down, we aren't consistent. We aren't taking care of our grassroots football. We're not taking care of, you know, the average kid. We are making it almost elitist in some ways, where these developmental academies cost, you know, thousands of dollars. Well, I grew up in Northern California, and there's a strong Latino population there, and I can guarantee myself and many of my teammates as a kid were not able to afford, if this was modern day, they could not afford travel or academy football or soccer. So the positives are, we have the system in place, we have the kids, we have the numbers for sure. Now it's just better educating everyone involved. To kind of piggyback on some of these points, though, I would definitely say that if we are going to be realistic about what we want to do, it's time to eliminate the word academy from every single team that wants to throw it on. That's definitely a buzzword. Eliminate things like premier and elite. There's nothing elite about it. It's youth soccer. And I think until USSF and MLS decide to fund academies 100%, we are going to be here in the next 4 years saying, well, what might have been. My vision is this. It's very simple. Academies should take the elite players. The elite players are always going to be elite. They're always going to be special in some different way. Instead of taking anyone who can afford it, take the kids that are truly elite. And that means opening up the scouting system and making money a non-issue. I think what turns off a lot of young players is they know they can't afford to go to a development academy. They know that mom and dad aren't going to be able to go from New York to San Francisco to play a game, and they know that they're going to miss a ton of school. So it shouldn't be a rich kid's sport. It shouldn't be, you know, this is a people's game, and in America we have a representation of all parts of the world, and we have all types of socioeconomic classes. To only serve those who can afford it is really doing us no good. It's really kind of setting us back, actually, because what's happening now is you have coaches and teams that are just saying, hey, we're an academy now, we're elite, and all of a sudden they're able to inflate their prices. And the last point I'll make is, until there's someone overseeing the actual development that's going on in these clubs, almost like an audit process. Hey, if you're selling that you're going to develop, are you selling a pipe dream at wholesale prices? A lot of these academies saying, hey, we'll get you a full ride to college. I played, for two Division I schools, and there's 9.9 scholarships for a whole team. All the coach has to do is bring in two or three internationals. They're getting full rides. They may not be any better than a local kid. They may not be any. They might not be a better student. So then we get into this, you're selling a college scholarship. You might as well just have the parent set aside money each year for that kid to go to the school that they want to get an education. But, and I would love to see USSF come in and say, hey, listen, you said you were going to develop 10 players of the caliber we wanted in our vision, and you didn't, you know, what we see is not, you know, up to standard. Let's rework the system. Let's get better coaches in. Right now, it's buyer beware, in my opinion. In St. Louis, I've seen what I call the amalgamization of clubs. So one club kind of absorbed all the others. So you eliminate competition then. Everyone's under the one same bland coaching system. And then you expect to produce special players. You expect them to be able to compete. So there's a lot of standards and stipulations in place that are very, very, very attractive on paper. One of them is not development. What's the end goal? I mean, I look at the Dutch model, and by age 12, players are able to do X, Y, and Z. I look at the development model here. By age 12, we say that, but all we really care about is, hey, did we make the playoffs? And did we win? And who got a trophy? And who got it? You know, so that's where I see things hopefully heading.
You know, that's interesting because, I tend to be a literalist. I mean, if an outfit is going to have the word academy in its name, then the damn thing should be an actual academy.
Yeah.
Because that was a new one on me. See, I didn't even realize that they had outfits out there that were basically just had academy on the name, and it was academy in name only.
Right.
Because, that's definitely ridiculous to me. that, yeah, if you're going to, like I said, if you're going to promote yourself as an academy, you better damn well be in an actual academy.
Well, the other issue, and that's so true, but the other issue, too, is the U.S. Development Academy system is, I think, starting at U13, and by then, compared to the world, it's too late. You need that system set up for kids at a young age. They don't have to go to live in this place where they're away from their parents like they might do in some countries, but you do need to get them early, because one of the things that what these academies are doing is they're taking the best players from all these clubs who developed these players. But then they're saying, hey, this is our player. Well, you didn't develop that player. You benefited from a ton of grassroots coaches, some street soccer the kid may have played, some good cultural, maybe it's a kid from a Hispanic background, maybe it's a kid from, an All-American kid who played baseball and football and is just very athletic and chose soccer. But, you can't claim development unless you're getting these kids from an early age, and you can see market improvement from, U8 to U10 to U12, and then we can kind of see, yeah, that academy is doing what they're supposed to do. And I think what we really do face here is we're still selling soccer, literally selling soccer to people. If we look at when NASL version 1.0 started, we don't need to sell soccer. People love soccer here. It's just as American as any other sport. And so we don't need to make it, academy or elite. That's not necessary. Just make it club level, and then the academy should exist, and they should be funded by, like I said, U.S. Soccer Federation, MLS, or even if they have a private academy, that's fine, fully funded. Bring the kids that deserve to be there, not the kids that can afford to be there, and we will see some market improvement.
No, very good points, and I agree with that point. And from your knowledge and your research, you bring up this point of report cards and, checklists. And I know Klinsmann has talked about that in the past, but I don't know how far down that goes. Do you know of any other nations who are, really efficient in this? And let's just go with the Netherlands, just because they're probably the example that the three of us agree with. Do they hold their clubs accountable in that fashion?
So the Netherlands it's a very unique situation there, because they have a couple powerhouses. I'll use Ajax as the standard here. Mm-hmm. What they promote is absolute ball mastery, and almost as total football, where at any point in the game, and we were seeing it with each iteration of the Netherlands national team, and even if you watch the Eredivisie, you will see that players can slot in as an attacking mid, go out to the wing. They can slide. Their fullbacks are just as good as our wingers. So one of the things that I've seen with Ajax is, even so far as the U8 level, if a kid doesn't have certain skills, the requisite skill, he's not going to be in the academy. Doesn't matter who his parents are, if his brother's in the upper level, he's not at the academy. As they get to the teenage years, they start taking things like body composition into play. So if the kid is a little husky, their job is not to get you in shape. Their job is to produce a player. So he might not be in the academy. The other thing that I've seen in certain areas is what they do in the academy is with the same thing they do at the senior level. So if you start looking at the trickle-down effect of how Ajax does it, or Barcelona, which is based off of Ajax's philosophy and model, you're going to be able to chart, hey, this kid can play in a 4-3-3, and he's 12. So when he's, 17, he's still playing that same formation with the same values that he would if he were to go on and play at the upper level. What we see here is we're still see some disparity between how the younger kids play, how the teenagers play, and then how kids going off to college or, what would be professional overseas, how they play. I'll bring up, the big one is, getting 10,000 touches a day. That was just something that a coach in Holland put me through. And he said, hey, this is what we're doing today, but kids do this all the time. I mean, they're getting 1,000 touches before school. They may do 1,000 at recess. When they get home, they're touching the ball, waiting for the bus. So it's not so much the number, but it's these kids are getting their work supplementary. They're not being kind of told. And I think when you look at how a report card, an objective analysis, you'll see that Americans, we value what's your mile time, what's your vertical, you know, what are your metrics, but not, you know, soccer specific measurements, in terms of, you know, I'm not talking about how fast can you, or how hard can you kick a ball. It's, you know, could you, if I asked you to go out and juggle the ball 300 times flawlessly, could you take this, you know, 60-yard ball down on your chest and play with your left foot, play yourself out of trouble? That's where I think we need to be. We can, I know a lot of people, especially playing Division I soccer, who are pure athletes. You gave them the ball, and it was like going to a black hole. That thing was never coming back. They were dribbling out of bounds. It was coming off, you know, and that was, you know, that was opted for a lot of teams, over a technical player who maybe wasn't as fast or as impressive on the outside. And if you look at the college game or even MLS, you'll see it's largely a physical and hard work determination. Those are other buzzwords that are my favorites. You'll see that that's really relied upon, not so much as, you know, this player maybe connected 100 passes. It's, you know, he ran 7 miles. Well, who cares if he ran 7 miles? We still lost, and he didn't do much. So, I mean, I had a tweet the other day where Messi had only run less than a 10K. Does that mean he's a bad player? And we know in our team, if you look at the heat maps and all those wonderful things that U.S. soccer pundits love to do, it's you're masking what really matters. I don't care how far we run. I don't care how many distance, how much distance we covered. That would be great if it was track and field. But, you know, so if we look at metrics, we're measuring the wrong stuff.
Yeah, because sometimes what people forget about the hard work is you could be digging yourself into a deeper hole faster. So, yeah, it's hard work and determination aren't bad things, but they got to be used properly. And as my American football coach used to love to say, is like, you know, it's not practice that makes perfect. It's proper practice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing with hard work and determination. You can run hard and be determined, but sometimes you run hard and run yourself into a hole.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's what I – there's a guy named Tom Beyer. He's an American who's been in Japan for decades developing, you know, Shinji Kagawa and Nakata, so players of that caliber. And he said something really interesting. He said if we don't focus on the upper levels, if we raise the bar for the weakest players, then what happens up top is they get better as well. One of the things that I've always been criticized of really saying is – here, hard work, determination, hustle, effort, these words, and in England as well, from my time over there, those aren't accomplishments, or they shouldn't be accomplishments. Those should be givens. You know, and I think that's where we kind of bleed over to these other sports that hit hard, hit, run through them. Well, that's going to take you so far. I watched, you know, Messi play yesterday against the team that took us to school, and he had 4 or 5 guys on him, and he still has the ball at his feet, and he's still riding challenges, and he's, you know, 5'7" maybe. So it's not so much about how hard can you run or how fast or whatever. It's how good are you on the ball. And, you know, if we're going to bring English football in, a guy like Raheem Sterling, little guy, fast, he's technically very good. And Brendan Rodgers said something very interesting. He said, you know, he is okay with the ball coming to him under pressure. We want our players to, you know, not create 6 yards of space, create 2 yards, get the ball, and then move on with it. You know, and I think if we can get our players to say, hey, it's okay to have a guy on your back. It's okay to receive the ball under pressure, because if you're technically good enough, there's no pressure. It's when you're fearing, you know, that confrontation or that mistake, and you know you don't have the skill to receive that ball, then you begin to, you know, you get players that are playing scared. And I'm not saying that's what happened to us in the World Cup, but this is what happens at the youth level. You get guys that are like, oh, I can't, I don't know what to do, and then they just kick it forward or kick it out, and then they regroup, which wouldn't be acceptable in Holland or, you know, La Masia for Barcelona.
Right.
Okay.
You know, that's
now,
definitely something we needed to learn over here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you're fine. Now, so we've covered the technical part, and so I think this is kind of the bridge here to where we could go into the tactical portion, and I'll get your thoughts and what you've learned from your research and your experiences. Now, you could see we're getting better. When I watch the U.S. youth teams play, I could tell that they're more comfortable on the ball, and for the lack of a better term, you could tell that they have a better footballing brain than our senior team players do. And I think we saw that in the World Cup a lot, to where we just weren't very composed, and sometimes we just didn't really know what to do. So developing the tactical, or I mean, the technical ability is key, but then also teaching the players, you know, how to play the game. And a lot of that, unfortunately, is instinctive. So what do some of these clubs in Europe and other countries do tactic-wise? How soon do they start teaching what you need to do in certain situations?
What I've seen, and I do agree with your point, as in the U.S., you set up the youth national teams. I watch them pretty heavily. They're good. They're tactically much better, more disciplined than our senior team, and that's so that's a result of you got two generations playing in this latest iteration. You got the guys who, you know, have four World Cups under their belt, and guys who are playing their second or third cap for the U.S. So that's a great point. Tactics, it's really not implemented until the players are technically able to carry out those tactics. So you won't hear 4-3-3 until a player is able to, you know, hey, you're right-footed, you're slotting on the left today. So I say 12-13 is when tactics become a little heavier. But then from then on, the key differentiator is consistency. You know, they're able to morph a 4-3-3 into another formation if need be, but they're not going to do it out of panic. They're going to use that 4-3-3 or the 4-5-1 to back up the philosophy that they've been taught. So they won't shift unless it's, hey, you know, this other team is just as disciplined as we are, so we're gonna need to shift formations. Where I will point out that the U.S. will shift because all of a sudden, you know, we don't have Josie available. Now we need to shift. It's like, well, no, we should be able to play that formation anyway. We should be able to play. He should not be the only player in all of the U.S. who can hold the ball up there. So that, you know, to me, the drop-off is we change tactics out of panic, whereas they change tactics out of necessity. You know, one can argue that that's my opinion, and that's what it is. But overseas, you would definitely see that not until the players are technically proficient are they going to even begin to subject them to playing complex tactical roles. They go by the number system, so your number four will be, you know, your center mid who's going to get the ball at the back four or the back three or, if, you know, whatever you're playing. So you're gonna have your number nine. He's going to play a number nine role. You're going to have your number six who's going to destroy things. So, you know, you have these – you know, you have it based off of a system, not off of like, well, he's tall, so I guess he's a forward. And I think that's where one of the biggest problems I see with youth soccer is we have these coaches just saying, hey, we're going to play a false nine. Do you know what a false nine is? Can your kids play a false nine? And why would they need to? And so, I mean, I think I spoke to an academy coach who was pretty pissed off at me for some of the tweets that I sent out. And I just said, hey, let me know how that false nine is working out, because I looked at, you know, the tournament he went to, and they lost one game, I think 7-0. And I said, you know, why didn't you just let the kids play in a formation that they're able to play? And he said, well, that's, you know, we're doing what, you know, Barcelona does. I'm like, you can't do that. It's just not possible. You can say you are, but it's so I think what you throw out, you see a lot of coaches throwing out what works overseas, but they're not really carrying it out.
Yeah, because that's, again, I'll use American football reference. That's sometimes that because an offense works at one level, somebody will try to implement it when you don't have the personnel, you know, to have a long passing game, because all your personnel, you know, over the last 3 years, you've been stocking up, you know, on like a run-based personnel or something. So that it's not just a simple question of, oh, well, this tactic works over here, so let's just install it here, when it's, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, myriad of other factors that go into that. And then at the you know, in soccer terms, that's kind of what I'm seeing now, that a lot of teams, possibly to their detriment, trying to use a false nine because, oh, well, it's worked for Spain the last few years, so let's try to use it, when, you know, their personnel isn't necessarily geared for it, or they don't have the technical abilities or the you know, the actual on-ball skill to play a false nine.
All right, next up here, I want to talk to you, and this was a fascinating article you had, John. I think it was titled The Shadow of Futsal. So what role can futsal play in development of players in this country?
You know, futsal, I grew up playing indoor soccer, so a little different than futsal. We had walls, it's like, you know, it's almost like a hockey, you know, soccer-hockey combination, and I'm sure you guys played it as well, where guys are flying around and there's maybe a two-point line all of a sudden. You know, it actually makes players, in my opinion, young players a little worse because they can rely on the wall, and it kind of eliminates technical importance, just run and gun. Futsal, the role I could play is, it doesn't take much to have a futsal court. There's a ton of unused tennis courts around the country. It takes, you know, minimal space. It keeps players involved. It uses a weighted ball, a smaller ball, but it's weighted. And players are playing offense, defense. Goalkeeper's heavily involved using his feet. The ball is moving. If you looked at the number of passes in a futsal match versus one half of soccer, you know, it would be in the hundreds versus maybe 100. So it's very interesting. It's reliant on technical ability. But players in futsal, what we've seen, and I spoke to the U.S. futsal national team coach, Keith Tozer, who's got a pretty rich tradition and rich history in indoor soccer. You know, he said, you know, you look at it, you take a kid who's never played soccer before, and you put him in an environment with futsal. He's getting more touches on the ball, or she's getting more touches on the ball. He or she is involved in the play all the time. They can't rely on walls. They're not, you know, really looking to do anything but move the ball, move the play forward, and then transition back. So it's almost like basketball. They're having a ton of fun, and games, you know, are back and forth more. It's not just, oh, well, the ball's down 75 yards, I'm just going to sit here and pick a daisy. They're involved. What I saw in my research was, Spain used to be the laughingstock of European football in a lot of ways. And in the 80s and the early 90s, they decided, amongst other things, this is not the reason, but it's one of them, to implement a league with tons of regional leagues around it. And they have like four divisions, with each division having groups with, you know, multiple teams representing every region of Spain. What this does is they looked at Brazil and they looked at Uruguay or in Argentina, and they said, well, okay, so these guys are good on the ball, they're fast, they're comfortable. What are they doing? Because in Spain we have great teams, we have big stadiums, and you know we have hardworking players. What's going on? And what they found was kids over in South America, and I have a really good friend from Sao Paulo, they didn't play conventional soccer until they're 14, 15, 16 years old. Futsal was the game. By the time they got to an actual soccer field with grass, it's almost like they had an eternity on the ball. They had so many options because it's not, you know, there's definitely more space, and you know, they had more time and then more space to work with, and they were technically great. So what Spain did and what the U.S. can do is we can take our urban areas and we can start converting some of these tennis courts, some of the unused basketball courts, even follow what Belgium did and create soccer cages. And it requires having a couple of goals with no nets. You know, give the players the environment to play in. And then let it rip. And I think what we're seeing is our futsal team is actually not that bad. I think we just beat France in a two-game series pretty handedly. We have indoor players. We have players that are good on the ball. It's just it's not valued as much in the outdoor games as it is in futsal. So futsal, it's almost like the paradigm is inverse. With U.S. Soccer on the outdoor level, it's, oh, how fast are you? How far can you run? How far can you kick it? Whereas futsal is like, how good is your touch? Mm-hmm. And then we can look at, oh, well, we're pretty good on the ball, so then we can start moving it. And one of the things that Keith mentioned was U.S. will become a futsal mecca. It's just U.S. soccer has to buy into it. They have to use that as a development phase, which Spain has done. So you had guys in the 80s and the early 90s and in the early 2000s who were playing futsal, and what we saw is a tiki-taka style come out of Spain that everyone loved and tried to mimic or kill if you're Jose Mourinho. you had a system of play that was very possession-based, and a lot of that is because of what Cruyff and the Ajax model embodied, but a lot of that is they could use that model because these kids have been playing futsal for years. So one of the things that I think we're going to see going forward is the introduction of more futsal leagues around the country. And I don't know how long it's going to take. I think Keith said it won't take quite as long as I think it will, but I think he's got the right vision, and I think he's got the right idea. Is we can take an East LA tennis court, paint some soccer lines on there, have a clinic, get some kids who never would touch soccer ball or see a grass field anyway, throw them in there and get them hooked, and then you can start to, you know, open up the soccer system to kids that would never have, you know, had the means to go to a suburban park and play.
Mm-hmm. How connected, I guess, is U.S. futsal to U.S. soccer?
You know, that was a great question that I had for Keith. You know, I was driving home from work and he called me, and that was one of the, I was really not prepared to, you know, write down everything he said, but I, you know, he said it's finally bought into it. It's working closely with the U.S. Soccer Development Academy. So they're using that as a, using futsal as a way to get players into the academy to that elite level that we talked about earlier. My opinion is it's not nearly at the level that it should be. If you look at, how often have you seen the U.S. futsal team play a game, or, you know, is there a futsal league in the States? And there's not. There's some indoor leagues, but it's not at the level that it should be. And I think U.S. soccer, it might be affiliated with U.S. futsal officially, but they're not doing nearly enough, in my opinion, to actually foster that growth. It's actually, you know, what Keith said and what I suspected was it's players who maybe had, you know, some success in college or no success. They didn't get playing time, and they kind of found their way to a place where futsal was played, and they kind of were the journeymen, and they kind of found their way to, you know, they're playing indoor soccer. So in the Midwest, you know, indoor soccer is pretty huge because our winters suck, and I'm speaking to someone in Alaska, so I'm not going to say it's that bad, but, you know, they found indoor players are the ones who are playing futsal, and I'd like to see that change. I'd like to see futsal be one of the youth games, like Little League Baseball, like, you know, youth soccer. Hey, you know, in the winter, let's play futsal, or in the summer, let's play futsal. My Brazilian friend said that one of the things that I would never would have suspected was his birthday parties, turned into futsal parties. You know, it was one of those things where, and right away, that was the first thing they played, because that's the accessible sport in Brazil. They don't have a lot of fields that are, you know, they're not going to let anyone go on there and kick around on grass. It's, you know, it's not something that we can really attest to here, because I can go to the park today and have any pick of the millions of fields that I, you know, are out there, and they all have nets, and some of them are even lined. Whereas there, that's not so much the case. You know, so futsal is space economy. It's easy to play, and I think we can do it here. It's just going to take a better effort from U.S. soccer.
Okay, fascinating. That's good information.
Yeah, no, I was definitely interested in after reading your futsal article, because as much as I like to think I'm a little ahead of the curve in what needs to be done in development, I hadn't even... The futsal and how it breeds those skilled players was a new one for me. So, like I said, I was definitely interested to speak to you after you, or, you know, hearing you talk after reading that article. Because it just so happened, weird coincidence, I think it was either the BBC or one of the other major websites in England had a similar type of article about how they need to start playing more futsal as well. So, like I said, it was pretty interesting, kind of a, you know, me and Chad always joke about synchronicity, mm-hmm. That, like, it was, like, 2 days after I read your article that, like I said, it was either the BBC or one of those guys had a very similar article.
Yeah. I actually spoke to the assistant English national team coach who read my article, and, you know, and he was very surprised that there wasn't, you know, more futsal here. And then we spoke at length, and he said, oh my God, we have the same issues in England. You know, not so much kids don't play soccer, they do, but it's like futsal to them is like a foreign game. And, you know, and we bounced some ideas off each other, and, you know, I asked him, I'm like, you know, can I contact you just about, you know, where your progress is? Because I think they see it. England's always been accused of not playing continental football. They kind of play their own style. And one of the things that he identified was we need to start getting more on the page of what our European counterparts are doing. So it was very interesting to see that, and that synchronicity, yeah, that happens. I think Twitter's probably the reason why. I think a lot of people say, hey, that's a great idea. I'm going to write it for my news outlet, and that's great. I mean, that the more messages that can get across in different areas, in different perspectives, I think that's exactly what we need, and we haven't had that until social media, so that's probably one of the coincidences of the synchronicity.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're getting down to the end of the show here, fellas, so I'll just have one more question that we'll go through here, John. And this is off the top of my head, but I think it's a question that should be asked, and it may tie in to what we've talked about before. In fact, I'm pretty sure it will. But so my question here, it's not a big secret that Jurgen Klinsmann, when he signed his contract extension before the World Cup, a few months ago now, or many months maybe even, that he got the technical director title as well. And so he's made a lot of the same points that you made, that we need to be, the kids need to be get as many touches as they can, and they need to do it year-round, not just during soccer season. So what can Jurgen Klinsmann, as the technical director, do? What is the one thing that you, if you had 5 minutes to talk to him about what he should do to help develop players, what would that one piece of advice be?
First thing I would ask him was, he got the job in 2011. Why didn't he start doing what he said he was going to do in 2010, which was open up the pyramid and kind of invert it? Because what we saw, and what I do get kind of agitated about, is this: he went straight to Europe and got a lot of these players he knew were in their youth academies, and I get why. I totally understand it. Like, they are what he would fit his model. He was able to get some players that by hook or by crook, they're American, as any of us here. What I haven't seen, and what I think he's going to do as a technical director, is going to get his vision throughout all the levels. I think this World Cup iteration was kind of the bridge between the young player and the player that exists in the former model under Bob Bradley and Bruce Arena. So what he's going to have to do, he's going to have to visit the current pay-to-play system and eliminate it, absolutely eliminate it. We have 77, maybe a couple more, developmental academies, which I talked about earlier. There should not be 77 developmental academies, because that becomes anyone can be an academy if they could pay for it, or you say they are. And then you look at the map, the distribution list I tweeted out a couple days ago, and it vastly underserves certain areas. So the scouting needs to be better. It needs to be – I'd rather have a kid from Nebraska be just as able to play on the national team than a kid from playing in Dallas or playing in L.A. or playing in St. Louis. So scouting, consistency, is our direction to just grind out games and – do what we've always done, or is it to become technical and become proficient players? And like anything in U.S. soccer, I think that the parts are in place, but I'd like to see that the sum is greater than the parts. I'd like to see that we have a cohesive movement where, we're not just relying on how many miles a guy can run or how many, saves our goalkeeper can make. Because that's the one thing that I mentioned in my latest article is, Tim Howard, I mean, he saved American soccer, in my opinion. Had we got blown out 10-0, we would have lost a lot of ground on where we need to be. And I think that's something that's been very much ignored. As a former defender, I'd be very, very embarrassed to let another team have pot shots at our goalkeeper. And I know that they were, definitely better than us on the ball. So that's something that we are seeing, is this bridge between the younger guys that were just kind of thrown in this really tough group in a tough environment, and then these older guys who've been around the block before but maybe weren't as ready to go. As technical director, he's got complete oversight, and I think he's going to do a good job. I'm not a Jurgen Klinsmann fan per se, but I think he's what U.S. soccer needs. A foreign, not so much a foreign coach, someone who thinks differently outside the box, who's won a World Cup, who's been in both a club environment, even though it wasn't very successful with Bayern Munich. But he understands the work necessary to smash the American system to pieces and then rebuild it the right way, not just the way it's always been done. I looked at you know, the pragmatic approach Bob Bradley would take. I looked at the way Bruce Arena would, you know, indoctrinate things, and I don't agree with either one of those approaches, because I think Bruce Arena said that, you know, our next coach has to be American, and you know, I think that's, you know, that's not where we need to be. We need to be the best coach, needs to be the best coach we can get. So being a technical director, the one thing I think is a risk is he has complete oversight. Kind of the benefit and the risk is, you know, who's going to challenge him, because he's going to need to be challenged. You know, if it's not working, who's going to come in and say, hey, you're the technical director. 2018 comes before we know it. What's working, what's not. I think we will see a better team come out of this. And I think we'll see a better program. We just need to see more trickle-down effect to make up some ground. And I think, you know, I think it's a good move. I question whether he used this World Cup as a, you know, a testing period. I don't believe in that. I think, you know, you should definitely have taken the strongest players and play the better system. But obviously he's got a vision, and we're going to see very quickly with the Gold Cup, the Olympics, Copa America. We're going to see really quickly what that vision looks like, because the world they're not watching us. Now we have an audience in the U.S., and I think he's going to have to be held accountable if it doesn't work. So, you know, I'd like to see more U.S.-born players get a look. A lot of people are talking about some of these, you know, younger players that you're trying to get them to be dual nationals and trying to get them citizenship. That's fine, but you're also looking at a country of 315 million who can produce players. So we can't always just look abroad. We have to kind of, you know, we have them here. Let's just develop them. So I think we're on the right path. I just don't see the execution at the moment, and that's what's exciting about this gap between now and 2018.
Okay. Well, very well said.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll just add something real quick, if it's okay. I hope we're this goes in terms of, like, you know, the future development of players for the U.S. men's national team. I don't think it's necessarily tied to Klinsmann per se, because I would hope it would be kind of like to go back to the Ajax and the Barcelona models. You reference like the tiki taka. A lot of times people kind of miscredit that to like Pep Guardiola and that system, when people kind of forget that was the culmination of like a 15-year process that started with Johan Cruyff.
Mm-hmm.
Tied through the total football movement at Ajax, but that Barcelona started implementing more of that style in the early to mid 90s, you know, when they had guys like Risto Stoichkov and other guys that names just popped out of my head, but just meaning that, you know, that wasn't something that developed over a 2 to 3 year period, as sometimes people kind of think it does. You know, that was the culmination of a decade, 15-year process. So I kind of think, I know, and, you know, I'm guilty of this too, that there's a lot of hopes for the development going to the 2018 World Cup, but I think in terms of long-term success that we may not see, and again, I hope it does come soon, but I think where it's going to bear fruit is, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 years down the line, because I'm like you. I wasn't necessarily pro Klinsmann per se when we hired him, but I was pro Klinsmann in the terms of, in my opinion, his hiring was more to do about changing the system than actual results on the field. So, like I said, that's where I hope it bears fruit, is not so much maybe in 2018, but, you know, 10, 12 years down the line, and then on after that. So.
Exactly. Now, that's why. Now, we spoke about this before when we were drawn into the group of death. And I said, Klinsmann could go 0-3, people. And he's going to keep his job, because his hiring was not about this World Cup. Now, I know people don't want to hear that, but it really wasn't. And I don't even know if, and I agree with Corey, that 2018, I think, is still probably too early, because, I mean, we're talking about changing a culture completely. And you just can't do that in 4 years or even 8 years. So
I want to see improvement, but I just don't want to fall into the trap of people expecting, you know, these drastic results when we go to, if it's going to stay in Russia.
Yeah. But I know, I definitely think you will see progress in 2018, but it's going to be by no means a finished product.
Yeah, right. Like, and I think, looking, yeah, so good.
No, I think I agree with both of you. I think, you know, that point about sustained progress over a decade, two decades, I think is where we need to be. And I think the cultural aspect is the key. I think, you know, American culture, sporting culture, so guilty of wanting results instantly. And this is the one sport where it's, you know, it's so closely tied to the mentality of the people and the attitudes that go along with those people that, you know, I'm guilty of it too. I didn't see the group of death as, you know, a death sentence per se. But I expected exactly what I saw. And I think going to 2018, it might be too soon. It might be too soon to have expectations. But, you know, going off my previous point and the points you guys just made, which are great, is Klinsmann is attempting to, or hopefully attempting to change the whole system. And that's behind the scenes. That's not what we see on the pitch. Right. And I think what it got exacerbated this year was Landon Donovan soap opera, which we won't talk about, but I think that was like, well, if we would have had him, and you know, it doesn't matter. So
yeah, sorry, we got a strict no Landon Donald. Oh damn it! Me too.
Do it again.
sorry,
but yeah, I agree with you guys. I think you know, if we hopefully we're not playing Qatar and we have, you know, guys training in the desert to get to play there, but you know, I think 2022 might be a realistic vision to see where the moves made today, you know, what kind of fruit it can bear.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we'll end on that positive note there. Thank you very much for joining us, John.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Uh-huh. No, you're
very interesting.
Yes, very informative. And remember, you can John Townsend, he writes on his for many websites, but all his articles are up on his website, farpostfooty.com. And this was such an excellent conversation. We will make sure that we have him on again if he is willing to associate himself with such daftness in the future.
Anytime, guys.
Yeah. So, all right. For Corey Chatelain, I am Chad Smith. This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at TwoDaftYanks.com or at TwoDaftYanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.